Hi, everyone, and welcome to my show called We Were Lied To About 9/11. I am your host, John Gold, and this show is part of the Soapbox People's Network. For this week's show, I'm going to talk to someone who doesn't ordinarily question 9/11, but does write about issues pertaining to the post-9/11 world. I want people who address these issues, who have a voice, to at the very least tell people that we were lied to about 9/11. When you have a corporate media that is unwilling to tell the people the truth, it is my opinion that it is the responsibility of those with a voice to inform the public. We also address civil liberties issues in the post-9/11 world. This show is dedicated to Dr. Martin Luther King.
Okay, this is John, and I'm here with Peter Van Buren. Peter, how are you doing today?
John, it's a pleasure to be with you. I'm doing well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Peter, for being on today. All right, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to read your bio. Peter Van Buren, a 24-year veteran of the State Department, spent a year in Iraq. Following his book, We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People, the Department of State began proceedings against him. Through the efforts of the Government Accountability Project and the ACLU, Van Buren instead retired from the State Department on his own terms. Peter's commentary has been featured in the New York Times, Reuters, Salon, NPR, Al Jazeera, Huffington Post, The Nation, Tom Dispatch, MichaelMoore.com, Antiwar.com, American Conservative Magazine, Mother Jones, Le Monde, Asia Times, The Guardian, Daily Kos, Middle East Online, Guernica, and others. He has appeared on the BBC World Service, NPR's All Things Considered, and Fresh Air, Current TV, HuffPo Live, RT, ITV, Britain's Channel 4 Viewmont, Dutch Television, CCTV, Voice of America, and more. Van Buren's new book is about the social and economic changes in America between World War II and the decline of the blue-collar middle class in the 1980s. You can learn more about Ghosts of Tom Joad, a story of the 90 pound 99%. It is available now. All right, so that's your bio. You've certainly been a lot of places, Peter, or on a lot of shows. and now
the John Gold Show.
Now we were lied to about 9/11, that show. All right, so before we get started, I want to say happy birthday to Dr. Martin Luther King. This show is going to be dedicated to him, and I think it's very fitting that today part of what we'll be talking about will be civil liberties issues. And before we get started, I want to quickly say one thing. This show is going to be an experiment of sorts. For years, I have been trying to get people that write about post-9/11 world issues like the wars, our loss of civil liberties, et cetera, to at least acknowledge or write about the fact that we were lied to about 9/11. To start looking at these issues through the we were lied to about 9/11 lens or filter. Peter is not known for questioning 9/11, but he does write about the issues I spoke of. I want to thank Peter very much for being willing to come on my show. Hopefully, I won't scare him too much. All righty. So my first question, what was the day of 9/11 like for you?
It's like pretty much everybody, maybe in the world, certainly Americans, it's unforgettable. I was assigned at the time to the American Embassy in Tokyo, Japan. And because of the time difference, 9/11 happened late at night for us. I was actually taking a shower, of all things. My wife was watching the evening news, and she said, "You better come see this. Something's happening in New York." And I ran down to see, and I arrived there to see the news just as the second plane hit the tower, or so they say. And I said, "Okay, I'm going to pack a lunch, and I'm not sure when I'm going to see you again. I'm going to go to work." And she said, "Well, why do you have to go to work? This is happening in New York. We're in Japan." And I kind of said, "Well, I think this is going to be a bigger deal than that." When I got to the American Embassy, it was well after midnight, our time in Japan, And there already was a large crowd of Japanese people who had assembled with flowers and candles. And we were welcomed into the embassy, and they were very sad for us. I just want to fast forward and contrast that against a much larger crowd that gathered in the same place in 2003 when we began the invasion of Iraq. That crowd was not very sympathetic, did not have flowers and candles, and in fact jeered us and cursed at us for what America was up to. And in my mind, I always hold those two events together, and I can't get past the controversy and the contrast.
Yeah, the contrast is amazing. After 9/11, most countries in the world were very supportive of America, including the ones that have been said to have not been sympathetic for America. We heard a lot of propaganda about different countries being happy that 9/11 happened and so forth, and that simply really wasn't the case. But you're right, before the Iraqi invasion, you know, we had, I think it was the largest recorded protest in history for an anti-war rally. And it still might hold the record. I'm not exactly sure. Okay, that's very interesting, because I haven't really talked to anybody who wasn't within this time zone when 9/11 happened. So that's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Have you ever had questions about what took place before or on the day of 9/11?
I have those questions, and I think that they differ in some ways and parallel in some ways what many people like yourself, I think, feel about 9/11. The questions I have are questions. They don't lead me directly to a conclusion. But, for example, I think there are significant questions/issues about the failures of the American government to identify the hijackers, to understand what was being put together in the United States prior to that terrible morning. We all know now that the CIA knew the hijackers had entered the United States. The FBI certainly knew something of some of these people. They had concerns that were being expressed about these folks taking flight training. There were a lot of pieces of the puzzle that were on the table, and we've never really had a full accounting of why those pieces were not put together, and whether what level of incompetence or whatever might have led to that. I think I also have some concerns that have not been answered about the attack on the Pentagon. I'm not a structural engineer. None of us are at this. I mean, most of us aren't. But what happened at the Pentagon doesn't seem to track with what I have seen in other instances in plane crashes. One of my jobs at the State Department was to deal with the deaths of American citizens overseas. And those deaths, in most cases, were quiet. Expats passing away in their own homes or hospitals, but it also involved air crashes. And I was at the site of more than one air crash, and the violence, the amount of material that's distributed over a large area is stunning when you see that type of thing. And, you know, the photos I saw from the Pentagon just simply don't look like what I had seen at these other air crash sites.
Go ahead.
So I don't know how to add that up, but it remains a significant question in my mind that needs an answer, and to a lesser extent, Shanksville, but still some of those same issues.
Well, okay, with regards to the Pentagon, it's definitely funny that you bring that up. I am someone who thinks that Flight 77 hit the Pentagon. There were a multitude of witnesses that saw an airliner crash into the Pentagon. There were pieces of debris with the American Airlines logo on them. Apparently, the DNA of the passengers and the crew were identified. There was a book called Firefight, which was written by 9/11 first responders who reported to the Pentagon, and they said that they found the plane chairs with bodies still strapped within them, inside the Pentagon. And it's interesting, the idea or the notion that Flight 77 did not hit the Pentagon was originally put forward by somebody by the name of Thierry Nixon. And he came out with that, I think, in October 2001. Then he wrote a book about it, and it was translated into 29 different languages and spread throughout the world. And very recently, within the last couple of years, the same individual reported that Prince Bandar was assassinated. And I don't know if you're familiar, but Prince Bandar is sure. a big character in the whole 9/11 scenario. So
sure. No, I know who he is.
I called the Saudi embassy, and they essentially laughed at me, but they told me he was not killed. Someone else called and confirmed that he was not killed. So, you know, if this person was wrong about that, he may have been wrong about the Pentagon as well. And I think he was. I think the question that people should be asking with regards to the Pentagon is, how is it possible that the most defended airspace in the world was left completely undefended 34 minutes after the second tower was hit, when everybody in the world knew that America was under attack, and yet a commercial airliner was able to penetrate that airspace and hit the Pentagon? And I'd like to know, you know, how was that possible? Exactly. But anyway, now some
the
of the other
questions in my mind is what you said. I mean, just simply what seemed to be common sense kind of questions that should have fairly straightforward, simple answers, don't.
Well, with regards to NORAD, I mean, they lied to the 9/11 Commission. The 9/11 Commission was considering referring the matter to the Justice Department for a criminal investigation because of those lies. You know, we don't know the truth about the air response that morning, among a number of other issues. Now, mm-hmm. Are you someone who believes that individuals within our government were simply incompetent with regards to 9/11?
Yeah, I'm going with that for two reasons. One is, of course, the Occam's razor. You know, the simplest explanation is often the right one. And the other is based on my own 24 years of federal government service. I, as you said in the bio, I worked for the State Department. Incompetence is unfortunately a predominant factor of government employment. The government doesn't necessarily hire the best and the brightest people. A lot of it has to do with the way the personnel systems work. And once you get inside the system, sucking up is the most important skill that anyone has over any kind of competency. And given the choice between saying something that's accurate, true, or correct, and agreeing with your boss, unfortunately, my experience was that most government employees simply nod and say, yeah, whatever my boss said. So I'm leaning heavily towards the incompetence theories to explain many government actions, as opposed to anything more nefarious. That said, it's also reasonable to say that kind of system, incompetent people who suck up to their bosses, certainly would offer fertile ground for anybody who was up to no good. A more senior person who wanted to pull off something, and I'm certainly not implying that I think that's what happened with 9/11, but the point is that when you want to get away with something and you're a senior person, that type of system makes it easier than if you had a lot of smart, sharp people underneath you.
Well, I've always looked at 9/11 not as an act of war, but as a crime. And as with every crime, there are suspects for that crime. And I honestly believe, based on everything that I know, that elements within our government and other governments, along with people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, have more than earned the title of suspect for the crime of 9/11. And I just want to quickly address the issue of incompetence. The Bush administration came into office wanting to go to war with Iraq. And there's also information to suggest they wanted to go to war with Afghanistan. These individuals, they wanted to go to war, they did. They wanted to make billions for their corporate friends, they did. They wanted to expand executive power, they did. They committed crime after crime after crime during their 8 years in office and remained Teflon coated throughout. So I don't see them as being incompetent. I see them as being able to do exactly what they wanted to do. I understand. No, keep in mind that I do know that within government there is incompetence and bureaucracy everywhere. But just as for instance, Alex Station, which was the Bin Laden unit, there was an instance where the two FBI agents were assigned to Alex Station, Mark Rossini and Doug Miller, and they found out that one of the hijackers got a U.S. visa. So Mark Rossini went to Michael Ann Casey to ask if he could send a cable to the FBI notifying them. And Tom Wilshire told Michael Ann Casey to tell Mark, no, you cannot send a cable. And he was surprised by this and so on and so forth. Later in the day, Michael Ann Casey sends out a cable within the CIA notifying different stations throughout the CIA that the FBI was notified. So when I hear things like that, they just sound criminal to me. And I found out recently, and I don't want to take up too much time on this, but I found out recently that the NSA was monitoring the two hijackers that were in San Diego, and they monitored about 8 calls of theirs going to the Yemen hub, the Al Qaeda hub in Yemen. And they said that they could only identify where the calls were coming into. They said they could not identify where the calls were coming from. And we found out recently from NSA whistleblower William Binney that the NSA did know the identity of the phone numbers coming from within the United States, and which means they knew the hijackers were in the United States and did not tell the FBI, very much like the CIA. And Thomas Drake, NSA whistleblower, confirmed that for me. So there are a multitude of lies. And the thing about all of this is there's one word, accountability. If individuals within our government were incompetent, were criminally negligent, or acted criminally, the word accountability applies to all of that. And we didn't see that after 9/11. We didn't see individuals within our government who should have been held accountable being held accountable. In fact, what we saw were people being rewarded and promoted who should not have been. And it boggles my mind. Every investigation we had into 9/11 had its own version of compromise and corruption, especially the 9/11 Commission. So when I say I'm talking to you as an individual who writes about post-9/11 world issues, but doesn't look at it through the lens that we were lied to about 9/11, which to me takes away the justification for everything that's been done in the name of 9/11. I'm not asking you to make it the issue for you. But if you talk about issues pertaining to the post-9/11 world, I think that it's in the best interest of the people that they are reminded of the fact that we were lied to about 9/11, especially by those, you know, those people who have a voice and reach a large portion of people, people like you, people like Glenn Greenwald, Noam Chomsky. When you have a media that doesn't work, a corporate media that doesn't do its job, it's up to the people who have a voice to let the people know what's going on. So that's essentially my argument to anybody who, you know, who writes about issues like this.
And you make good points, and I think this is one of the reasons why we've become, I guess, online friends would be a way to put it, is that it's very hard to write on these issues because the dialogue, the narrative, if you will, is so polarized. You have the government's line and the people who support the government's line, which is very narrowly focused on a very sort of broad narrative that chooses to ignore many important questions, which we've already covered some of those. The other side of this is oftentimes brushed off too casually, and whenever you start to talk about something that veers from the government narrative, you bring in a lot of a static, if you will. You bring
Believe me, I'm well aware. I've spoken to so many journalists over the years who used to actually report on some of the issues of 9/11, and I'm like, why aren't you still doing it? And they said, well, because when I write about this stuff, I get thousands of emails telling me, why didn't you cover this, accusing me of this or that because I didn't cover this, and they just don't want to touch it anymore. And I completely understand that. But in the same token, it's still our responsibility. You know, this show is dedicated to Dr. Martin Luther King, and mm-hmm. his famous saying is, silence is betrayal. And I firmly believe that applies to the issue of 9/11. All right, let's get on with the questions. What did you do while you were at the State Department?
I did a number of things. Most people that work as foreign service officers, which is what I was, diplomats, are considered what we call generalists. You do whatever in the State Department needs to be done, and your role changes oftentimes from assignment to assignment. However, primarily, my core function, if you will, was called citizen services, and my job was to assist Americans who got into one form of trouble or another overseas. Some people call it social work on steroids, though there is a large bureaucratic part to it. I helped issue passports, register births, do the paperwork when people passed away abroad, those type of things. But I also was deeply involved in the problems that American citizens had of a more extreme nature, when people got arrested, when people were the victims of crime, and all the way up to disasters like plane crashes, the Asian tsunami, earthquakes. You name it, if it can happen to an American citizen overseas, it was my job to deal with that in some fashion.
What are the top three reasons? I'm sorry, I was going to ask, what are the top three reasons Americans get arrested overseas?
The top three are drugs, drugs, and drugs. There's really not much else. There's the occasional whatevers, but quite seriously, it's drugs. Americans display oftentimes unbelievable levels of stupidity in dealing with illegal substances abroad, and oftentimes amazing levels of ignorance that the laws work very, very differently in other countries. In Japan, for example, where I worked, the amount of marijuana that you're caught with determines what, according to their law, what your intent was. In other words, if you have over, and I don't remember exactly, but it's a relatively small amount, if you have over a relatively small amount in your possession, the law says says you were intending to sell it. And there's not really a lot of argument allowed under the system over there. If you have more than whatever it is, you're considered a dealer. And Americans often didn't get that and ran into trouble. There were cases where I worked also in Korea. Most of my time was in Asia, you know, where a young person would come back from a week in Thailand with a scraggly beard, long hair, a backpack, torn clothing, and was surprised when he was selected for extra scrutiny at customs at the airport. And they found some dope on him. You know, things like that. There were obviously serious crimes, but in many cases, it was usually guilty of stupidity, I hate to say.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. You hear that, American? Stop doing drugs. Anyway, please bleep.
I'll say
briefly.
Stop being stupid. Yeah.
Yes, please, America, stop being stupid. Please briefly describe what your book, We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People, is about, and what happened at the State Department after you released it.
As I mentioned earlier, we were all considered generalists. We knew what needed to be done. And by the time the Iraq War had dribbled and drabbed and sputtered into 2009, the State Department had largely run out of people who had been to Iraq as part of what was then the world's largest embassy in terms of staffing. And so they started to dig a little deeper into the ranks, and I was voluntold that it was my turn to go to Iraq. I was assigned to lead two reconstruction teams. If you'll recall, we were going to win the war by creating democracy, helping the Iraqis build roads and schools and bridges that would, in some sense, defeat terrorism. It was never a very well thought out plan, and my job was to go out and make it work.
The entire Iraqi occupation, as far as I'm concerned, was illegal. So.
Yeah, it was the stupidest. It was one of the stupid things in a stupid system that was never going to work. And my goal at the time, and I was, you know, a relatively mediocre bureaucrat. I was not a highly politicized person. I had my opinions and all, but I worked for the government. I was not a political appointee. Ronald Reagan was president when I joined the State Department, and I served under every president, Republican, Democrat, since then, until I retired under Barack Obama. Anyway, so my goal was to go to Iraq, not get myself or anyone else killed, keep my head down, and try to just get through the year that I was assigned there, get back home to my family, and get back home to doing the work for the State Department that I enjoyed. That was the plan. The reality was that as soon as I got there, literally from day one, I began realizing that the whole thing was a lie. It was a scam from top to bottom to funnel money into the hands of contractors, to waste money, to create photo opportunities. There was no plan at all to quote, win the war. And in fact, most of what we were doing was ridiculously counterproductive, harmful to both our side and the Iraqis and everyone else. And this changed me. It was that moment of clarity, that epiphany, that attack of conscience that changes people, that causes them to realize that they've been living in a bubble that was wrong. And I came back from Iraq, and it's a longer story, but I mean, the short version is that nobody would listen to me. Nobody was interested in what I had to say about all this. And I decided that I was going to write a book. I never really gave a lot of consideration to going to a journalist. I think I was unaware of how that really would work. And I think also I wanted to tell my story the way I wanted to tell it. And I wanted to tell it in the length that it needed. I didn't want this to be, you know, a little blurb that appeared on page 17 somewhere. And so I wrote a book. about it and basically outlined exactly what I saw in Iraq, what I did personally. And the book achieved some success, some notoriety perhaps, and the U.S. State Department reacted strongly by attempting to beginning the process of prosecuting me under the Espionage Act. They couldn't kind of make that work since I revealed no classified information whatsoever, so they switched over to trying to fire me for all sorts of dumb, trumped-up reasons. The main issue was they were going to try to take away the pension and the things that I had earned over the course of an otherwise decent career and leave me impoverished. That was their goal. And thanks to some very nice people and some very good lawyers, including the ACLU and a woman named Jesselyn Raddick. You may recognize her name, and if
yes,
not, jot it down, because among other things, she defended Thomas Drake, who you mentioned earlier. She's worked very closely with Bill Binney, who you mentioned earlier, and she's currently the lead attorney on Edward Snowden's defense team. The joke is she got to practice with me, and then once she got good at it, you know, she moved on to the big guys.
Now, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. No, you go ahead, please.
Are you considered to be a whistleblower? Do you have whistleblower status?
Yes.
Protection?
I certainly consider myself a whistleblower. I was in the process of getting the formal version of federal government whistleblower status when the State Department and I decided that we needed to simply divorce and move on with our lives. At that point, I was no longer a federal employee. The book had been out for a year, and the whole question of whether I needed the official status or not became kind of moot. And so it fell to the side. But I absolutely consider myself a whistleblower. And with a little humility, I'm very pleased and proud to say that very courageous men like Tom Drake and Bill Binney welcome me as a fellow whistleblower.
Well, no, I consider you to be a whistleblower. It's just a lot of people file for status and so forth so they can get protections so they don't get retaliated against. You know, unfortunately, whistleblowers in today's era are not liked at all. I mean, I guess they've never been.
Tell me about it.
But they, you know, Obama has prosecuted more whistleblowers than Bush did. And
any other president.
Yeah, and he's used the Espionage Act more than any other president, I think.
Yep, that's correct.
You know, and it's an example of how Obama has continued and expanded upon most of Bush's worst policies. Now, I'm going to quickly skip ahead because we don't have a lot of time.
Sure.
Since 9/11, we have lost a plethora of civil liberties. Which civil liberties do you think have been most affected by the so-called war on terror?
Time after 9/11, I've come to refer to as post-constitutional America. The idea would be that prior to the American Revolution, you had the United States under the thumb of a monarchy. After that, for 220-some years, you had the United States struggling to work itself out under a constitution. It was certainly an imperfect process. Dr. King is a perfect example of how that process never fulfilled itself. But the point was it was an attempt to do the right things, and then there was some progress made. 9/11 changed all that and launched us into an era where we no longer have the rights that we enjoyed under the Constitution. Among the rights that were lost most significantly, and it's hard to kind of separate how they because they fit together, but I would have to say that the most egregious is the Fourth Amendment right to privacy against unlawful search and seizure. Edward Snowden has been the most eloquent spokesperson for that. And we've learned that the NSA, and as the poster child for all this, though I'm sure there's other parts of the government deeply involved, is now intrusive into nearly every aspect of all of our lives. There is no such thing as privacy in the United States right now. Any privacy that you might enjoy is simply because the government chooses to allow you to have that privacy for whatever particular reason. But dovetailing with that, I think, is the loss of our First Amendment rights, the ability to speak freely, to criticize the government, to assemble, to do all the things that the Founding Fathers said we needed to do to oppose a monarchy. If you can't think in private, if you can't talk in private, if you can't communicate with others in private, that dramatically limits your ability to speak openly. And so I'm afraid that these things fit together in ways that are quite synergistic, but not in a good way, John.
Well, you spoke of the First Amendment, and part of the First Amendment is a free press. And after 9/11, a lot of people were afraid to report or ask the toughest of the tough questions. Helen Thomas spoke about it. Dan Rather spoke about it, how reporters were afraid to dissent, essentially. And, you know, I know a couple of journalists, someone like Robert Scheer, who wrote for the Los Angeles Times. He wrote an article called "What We Don't Know About 9/11 Hurts Us." And he also wrote a couple of articles dissenting against the Iraq War, and the LA Times let him go. Now he started Truth Dig. You know, I just looked at Reporters Without Borders, and the United States is ranked 46th in the world for freedom of the press. And, you know, for a country that supposedly has the freedom of the press in their constitution, that's absurd. And I think, you know, the press has been very dangerous in a lot of ways as far as propagandizing the American people, as far as fear-mongering with the American people, as far as misrepresenting causes, like, for instance, the 9/11 truth movement. They would focus on, you know, two theories, the controlled demolition and the missile hitting the Pentagon, and ignore things like how corrupt the 9/11 Commission was and how corrupt Philip Zelikow, who was the executive director of the 9/11 Commission, was. And just misrepresent us. We were supposed to be people supporting the family members seeking truth, accountability, and justice for what happened to their loved ones that day. And they portrayed us in such a way that now, when you hear the phrase 9/11 truth, you know, people or truther, people think, you know, that they're the equivalent of a baby killer or a dog torturer. So they've essentially made it impossible to dissent in this country. And one of the things that 9/11 did, John Ashcroft, one of the first things he did after 9/11 was reinstate COINTELPRO. There, you know, there's a number of instances where people are being entrapped, you know, made to look like terrorists, and it's just not true. And, you know, I consider myself, I'm fairly well known, I guess, so I assume that everything that I do is being monitored. In fact, when I went to the White House to chain myself to the White House fence to protest the 9/11 lies, a Capitol Police officer came up to me and he said, "Is your name John Gold?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Are you still planning on chaining yourself to the White House fence?" I said, "Yes." And that's actually not the first time I was spied on. I belong to an organization that Cindy Sheehan founded called Peace of the Action, that an organization called ITRR was subcontracted by the Pennsylvania Department of Homeland Security, and they actually spied on us. And they wrote reports that said we were, you know, going to be violent and so forth in an upcoming action, and we're nonviolent people. And they would give these reports to the Department of Homeland Security. And it's just not true. So, you know, the wiretapping, the press, the COINTELPRO, the search and seizure, the privacy, you know, we have supposedly the right to address our government with a redress of grievances. And can you, you know, we don't get the time that lobbyists do. We can't go into our representative's office and, you know, have a nice conversation with these people. It's next to impossible, unless you're a lobbyist who has a lot of money and so forth. And it's just getting worse. And, you know, again, if we were lied to about 9/11, there's no justification for any of what they're doing. So that's how I look at it. Now, is there anything else you want to say about civil liberties?
Well, just the idea that there's another thing that goes on with all this, and I think you've touched on it there, and that is there's this lack of freedom to speak there's two ways to it. One is the overt stuff, and I think you've made explained some of all that. But then there's also the idea that not everybody is courageous enough to stand up to the government. An awful lot of people see what happens to others and sort of self-censor themselves. And, you know, the government knows that. They know that the easiest voice to silence is the one that never speaks up. And so for every person that gets arrested or intimidated overtly, as you were describing, there's a lot of other people who say, you know, it's just not worth the trouble to me. I'm just not going to get as far as John did or Jim Risen did or anyone else. I'm going to shut the hell up myself before the government even gets as far as me. And I think that in many ways becomes even a bigger danger. The overt cases are known and can be talked about and perhaps dissected and maybe even pushed back against. But all those Americans out there who remain silent out of fear, I think that's where the real danger lies.
Absolutely. And, you know, I said the other day that the people have the power to change things. And as soon as they realize that, you know, watch out, world. But, you know, unfortunately, a lot of people have fallen for what I call the empire's tricks, the propaganda, the fear-mongering, and so forth. And, you know, as you said, people are apathetic. And as long as they have their cars, their houses, their TVs, and so forth, they don't concern themselves. And one of the reasons why is because of what you said, how they see other people being treated. And, you know, it's our responsibility as citizens to be as responsible as we can be as citizens. And one of the things we need to do is when our government does questionable things, we need to point that out to people, I think it's imperative to do so, regardless of what the outcome might be. And I understand people with families might have a problem with that, you know. Activism might be a single man's game in a lot of cases, but anyway. All right, the next question. What is your opinion with regards to allying ourselves with Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda-linked groups in places like Libya and Syria in order to take out their leaders?
We are, of course, our own worst enemies, not only in allowing our government to use things like 9/11 and quote-unquote terrorism to take away our rights, but also in sort of the good guy, bad guy of the moment strategy, which seems to be what our government does. We are opposed to one group while it's to what we perceive our advantage, and then who knows, then all of a sudden, soon after that, we're on the same side as them. What's going on in Iraq right now is a perfect example. We're claiming that Iran is one of the greatest dangers to the Middle East and peace there, and then at the same time we're tacitly, if not directly, supporting Iran's incursions into a foreign country, Iraq. We can't seem to ever get our stuff together, if you will, on this. We're so focused on short-term expediency that we just fail to see beyond the next corner and act surprised every time it comes up and bites us in the backside.
I think that it's done purposely. I mean, we've, for years, since the 80s, we've allied ourselves with the Mujahideen. Throughout the 90s, we allied ourselves with Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda-linked groups in, you know, the Balkans and the Caucasus. And this is a practice that we take part in. It's just, it's a formula that the United States likes to use. You know, we're bombing Syria right now, but before that, we were, you know, we were entrenched in Syria trying to, you know, help to stabilize that country for years, long before Obama came into office. And we were also using them to torture people for us. So anyway, you know, then the Saudis started sending in rebels into Syria under the direction of Bandar. Then the United States was sending the rebels intelligence. Then they were sending them arms. Then we started sending in rebels from Jordan. And, you know, then Syria became what it did. And it was all to take out Assad. You know, last year when the chemical weapons strike supposedly happened, and we still don't know who that was, you know, Obama was itching to bomb Syria, and people think he was talked out of it. But if you look at what they did, they essentially got Assad to get rid of his weapons of mass destruction and then decide to bomb him. And they used the excuse of ISIS, which was really a thing of our own creation, along with our allies and so forth. And now, you know, surprisingly, a year later, we're bombing them. And they did the same thing with Gaddafi. They made Gaddafi get rid of all of his weapons of mass destruction. And then a couple of years later, you know, we bombed the shit out of them illegally. And we allied ourselves with Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda-linked groups and so forth. And that's, you know, we're supposed to be in this war on terror and allying ourselves with Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda-linked groups. That seems like a big contradiction to me. And it kind of takes away the justification, you know, in my mind, for the war on terror.
I agree.
So, you know, and I think it's criminal. I really, really do. And there are questions about these allegiances with regards to 9/11. You know, as far as Saudi Arabia is concerned, the Pakistani ISI may have had something to do with 9/11. And these were all allies of ours that, you know, worked with us to help control rebels in different places and so forth. So anyway, do you think America has reached a state of fascism? And what solutions do you think exist?
You know, I think that's a great question for us to end on here, John, because I am saddened and embarrassed to say that we are significantly headed into a fascist state, if not already there. The only reason I express some hesitancy is because there are so many things that I think we're still waiting to learn about. And I don't think any of them are going to be particularly good. Look at what we didn't know prior to Edward Snowden. And so I'm afraid that fascism is our future, if not already the reality. Fascism, you know, it comes in different forms, and it morphs to fit the particular country that it's in. Everyone says, well, look, you know, look at the Nazis. This certainly isn't anything like that. And they're correct. This certainly is not anything like that. It is a uniquely American form of fascism where capitalism is allowed to flourish, and there does exist something of a free market. If you have want to go out and figure out a way to make money, the government has no great issues with any of that. People are allowed to say and do things within certain boundaries to create the impression that it's not a fascist state. There's not really the same need to be encompassing the way, say, the Nazis were. We'll use them as a good example. That's one everyone kind of agrees on in terms of being the ultimate fascist state. Our government has been a lot more clever about it. They've picked and chosen which areas they wish to exert their authority in and which areas really don't concern them and they don't really care particularly about. If somebody, you know, becomes a real troublemaker, that's dealt with. But, I mean, otherwise, you know, you want to go out and march around, whatever. The government isn't going to start machine gunning those people down in large numbers. The occasional one is probably a valuable lesson. But in terms of civil liberties, in terms of truly the ability to speak out, and particularly in terms of the ability to challenge the government's power, I'm afraid to say that we are, in fact, a fascist state.
Yeah, and fascism, you know, some define it as a combination of corporations and government. And our government is bought and paid for. Everybody there is bought and paid for in some way or another. And they do not work in the people's interests. They simply don't. And, you know, you see the fascism when you try to exert your dissent. When you try to dissent, that's when you start to see the signs of fascism. And I call it a soft fascism because you're right, there aren't, you know, Gestapo people banging. Well, there are instances of it, but it's not an everyday thing where people are barging into your house and arresting you and taking you away to a camp somewhere or, you know, stuff that overt stuff like that doesn't happen like it did in Nazi Germany. But that's not to say I can't see us getting to there. I mean, we just keep going in a horrible direction. And, you know, I want to say it. I don't want to say that it's all based on 9/11, but it's very much based on 9/11. We are living in the post 9/11 world. And I want to finish on by simply saying that please consider that when you write an article, you think about the fact that we were lied to about that day. Maybe just mention that briefly in any of the articles that you write. And, you know, be prepared. You might get some flack from people telling you about theories and all that stuff, but you just have to ignore that and just do what's right, what I think is the right thing to do. And
you're
Peter, I want to thank you.
Side, John. Thank you.
I want to thank you very much for taking the time to be here today. Is there anything you'd like to promote besides your latest book?
Not at this time. I'm just going to let folks know that I am working on a third book. This one is a little bit different. It's a novel, and it is an anti-war book built around what I hope to be a pretty good war story. It is set in an alternative history where the United States did not develop the atomic bomb at the end of World War II and instead chose to invade Japan, a traditional invasion, if you will. And it uses that as a stage to talk about war, to talk about what happens to people in war, both on the military side and on the civilian side, and how a society chooses to carry out its wars. Hopefully, the reader will understand that I'm not really talking about Japan and World War II. That's just a kind of a nice way to get the medicine along with a little bit of sugar. You know, if you start right off and say Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, World War, War on Terror, You stumble right into people's polarized opinions. And it's very, very hard to be persuasive at that point because folks already have made up their minds on all those issues. But I think if you set that same philosophy, I guess, the same political points in a more neutral setting, in this case fiction, hopefully I'll have a chance to reach an audience that otherwise would not be open to new ideas, and create the idea that you can tell a war story and come to the end of it and realize how anti-war what it was that you just read. We'll see. Give me about a year, and I'll come back on and talk more about it.
That's awesome. Good luck with that. And your current latest book is called Ghosts of Tom Joad, A Story of the Town, 99%, and it's available now. So thank you very much, Peter, for your time today.
John, it's a pleasure. I look forward to talking with you again sometime. Take care.
All right. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you.
All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper. If I lived in China or even Russia or any totalitarian country, maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over there. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right.